Scholarly Studies at Marine Corps University presents Winter or Spring, Islamists, the Military, and Post-Revolution Politics in Egypt. Presented by Mr. David Schenker, Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This is the sixth lecture in the series being hosted by MES at MECU entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. David Schenker is the ASEAN Fellow and Director of the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Previously, he served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as the Levant Country Director. In that capacity, he was responsible for advising the Secretary and other senior Pentagon leadership on the military and political affairs of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and the Palestinian territories. He was awarded the Office of the Secretary of Defense Medal for Exceptional Service in 2005. Before joining the U.S. government, Mr. Schenker was a fellow at the Washington Institute and a project coordinator for a Bethesda-based contractor of large, centrally funded U.S. aid projects in Egypt and Jordan. Mr. Schenker has authored two books, Dancing with Saddam and Palestinian Democracy and Governance, an Appraisal of the Legislative Council. He wrote a chapter on U.S.-Lebanese Relations, published in Lebanon, Liberation, Conflict, and Crisis. More recently, he authored Egypt's Enduring Challenges, a monograph focusing on post-Mubarak Egypt. Mr. Schenker's writings on Arab affairs have also appeared in a number of prominent scholarly journals and newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, The New Republic, and the Weekly Standard. He has an MA in Modern Middle Eastern History from the University of Michigan, a certificate from the Center for Arabic Study Abroad at American University in Cairo, and a BA in Political Science and Middle East Studies from University of Vermont. This lecture took place Thursday, 29 March 2012, Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
The last one will be on 19th April, Thursday, same time, and it will feature Dr. Kristen Dewan from American University. She has done quite a bit of work on Bahrain, and I have heard that she is up to date. So please join us with that. And if you have any questions about this lecture series, we have publications on most of them. It will come either in short form. In our newsletter, you'll see some copies of that in the back with Dr. Cordesman from a year ago, but came out now, and also Dr. Sonia Chaptai on Turkey. Those are there. We also will publish a few of them together in a monograph series that will include Libya, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. So please be in touch, and Adam Seitz, who's there to my left, runs all of this, so please contact him and he will make sure that you stay on our list and also receive those publications and any other. And also you can have a DVD which will include basically what you see here. Without further ado, let me introduce to you someone that knows a lot about this region and has promised that he will take questions not only on the subject at hand, which is Egypt itself, large enough and complex enough, but also Sir David Schenker will take questions if you have on Syria and that part of the world. He's been publishing a lot both on Egypt and Syria. Sir David Schenker currently works with the Middle East Institute, Washington Institute for Near East Studies. That's the same place that we have Dr. Chaptai, so now we have two able speakers from that organization. He is the Afrosian Fellow and Director of the Program Policy Institute. And previously, Mr. Schenker was at the Office of the Secretary of Defense for the Levant region, covering the countries of Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and the Palestinian territories, advising SACDEF and other senior Pentagon officials. And prior to that, Mr. Schenker was also working with a Bethesda-based contractor with USAID dealing with Egypt and Jordan. He is author of numerous, and if you go and see what he has in the Washington Institute currently, I think he's a prolific writer. I envy you. He writes a lot, but including several books. One of them is called Dancing with Saddam, published in 2003. And another one, The Palestinian Democracy and Governance, an appraisal of the Legislative Council in 2001. He also has books on Egypt, which is 2001, Egypt's Enduring Challenges. And I think if I read all of your accomplishments, we will. It is very long, and he is. But Washington Institute has a very, very good website. I can advertise for them. You can see their publications. You can actually download them. Mr. Schenker and other of his colleagues. You can go there and see what he's written. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation. Thank you very much.
The different chapters of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East are relatively parochial. is concerned about their own countries. Egypt is long, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is concerned about Egypt. Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, i.e. Hamas, is concerned about the West Bank, Gaza, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, etc. But there's a linkage here. There's a very strong linkage that we're just starting to see. The best example of that happened about a month ago, when there was a guy named Abdelmajid Tulebah, who was the former head of the Jordanian Muslim Brotherhood, who had been given a seat in the Jordanian Senate by King Abdullah. And he was told by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt that he had to leave the Jordanian Senate. And he did. So there's an element of operational command that we're just seeing start to emerge that is cross-border. And this is a pretty important, potentially, development moving forward. So Egypt's a regional trend center, and what happens there is going to have an impact across all the region. There's several key trends I think I want to talk about today about what's going on in Egypt, and things basically that you should keep your eyes on in the next months and years, and by extension, beyond Egypt, throughout the region. Number one, the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is the most obvious development. In Egypt, we had parliamentary elections in Egypt that lasted from November through January of this year, and the Muslim Brotherhood's political party, the Freedom and Justice Party, took 46% of the 508-member Egyptian parliament. You know, the organization itself didn't have a political party, and it was actually illegal until 2011. Now, of course, in the 2000 elections, the Muslim Brotherhood essentially got 20% of the seats, but they were running as independents. Now they have a party and they control the parliament. 47%, I think, wasn't much of a surprise. Most of the predictions have been between 30% and 40% of the parliament. I lived in Egypt, and I traveled there frequently. I lived there for a couple of years in the early 1990s. And back then, I'd say there was about 15% of the women that were wearing hijab. Today, if you go to Egypt, it's at least 80 to 85% of the women who are wearing hijab, and maybe 5% wearing the niqab. This is where the Saudi style, when we see the eyes of Afghanistan. I actually asked about 2 years ago, I was in Egypt, and I asked the deputy head of the deputy supreme guide, or general guide, as they call him, of the Muslim Brotherhood, number two in the Muslim Brotherhood. I asked him, I said, hey, what accounts for this? What accounts for this huge prevalence of women wearing the hijab? This is 2 years ago. He said, we won. Right? We may not be in a legal political party. We may not be able to participate, but the people are with us 100%. And I think socially, this suggests the hijab, not the hijab, that the Muslim Brotherhood is very popular in Egypt. There's no doubt about that. This wasn't a fraudulent election. It was free and fair. Part of this also is that there was never a real political party in Egypt. I mean, you had the government party, which was the National Democratic Party, that was Mubarak's ruling party. And then you had, and that wasn't really a party, it was the dictator, essentially the authoritarian leaders, friends and cronies, etc., people who benefited from the regime. And you had other parties who were co-opted by the regime. And the Muslim Brotherhood was the only party, or the only group, that had a platform that was coherent, and that ran for parliament, that existed, and that provided services. If you've never been to Egypt, you'll know the government has never been particularly good at providing services. In 1992, I was in Egypt for an earthquake. Hundreds of buildings fell in Cairo. People were without shelter, people couldn't get food. You went out on the streets, you didn't see the government. You saw the Muslim Brotherhood for putting people in shelters, giving them food. The government was largely was corrupt. So it's no surprise that the Muslim Brotherhood was popular. So they did well. And this happened actually in Tunisia, right? In Tunisia, the Ennahda, the Renaissance Party, which is essentially the Tunisian chapter of the Muslim Brotherhood, got 40% of the parliament. Mind you, Tunisia is probably the most secular liberal country in the Arab world, with the exception perhaps of Lebanon. So, the second key trend I want to talk about was actually the surprise in the elections, right? So the Muslim Brotherhood, 47% wasn't a surprise. The surprise, actually, was the Salafis, right? These are the more militant, more conservative Islamists, who actually won 27% of the seats in the Egyptian parliament. This wasn't predicted. Although, interestingly, you guys probably couldn't have read this because it was in WikiLeaks. It's illegal for you to read it, but the U.S. Embassy in Egypt actually wrote a cable in 2009 called The Rise of the Salafis. So the State Department actually got it right. They weren't talking about this, you know, way down to the elections, but this is a phenomenon that was a growing phenomenon that wasn't readily apparent unless you went out in the countryside. But the thing about the Salafis, in addition to having these views, and we'll talk about the views in a second, is that compared to the Muslim Brotherhood, it's relatively easy to become a Salafi. If you actually want to be a member of the Brotherhood, a colleague of mine at the Washington Institute, Eric Kramer, wrote a great article on foreign affairs about the process of joining the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's actually an 8-year process to be a full member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And if you want to be a Salafi, you just have to take the oath. Say, hey, I'm going to live by the Quran and the Hadith, and you grow a beard, and you're a Salafi. Right? It's actually quite popular among the youth, and it's nipping at the heels of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're going to actually, over time, take up some of the membership. So together, between the Brotherhoods and the Salafis, you have about 75% of the parliament that is controlled by the Islamists. And what are the liberals? Right, the people who actually made the revolution, right? They're nowhere to be found. They don't exist. They're politically impotent, divided. I think, you know, this is sort of the curse of democracy, which is that, you know, we let a thousand flowers bloom. We don't necessarily agree on things. And you have all these different political parties of the liberals who competed against each other, and even they couldn't win barely any seats in the parliament. Some people actually were relieved, something we can hear in Washington, some people are relieved that the Muslim Brotherhood actually controls parliament and not the Salafis, right? The Muslim Brotherhood, they're the moderates, right? Relatively speaking. Well, they're not so moderate, right? I mean, we have to know what they say. Muhammad Badia, who is the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, he's a guy who actually spent time in prison with the Said Qutb, the guy who founded the Muslim Brotherhood before he was executed during the Nasser era. He said 2 months ago in Cairo that the new Islamist government in Egypt will, quote unquote, lead to a rightly guided caliphate that will instruct the world. Right? He said that scenario. It's there. Now people get, they want to establish a caliphate, that's something new, right? That's not a good thing. This is an Islamic state that crosses borders. And all of a sudden, actually, there was a clarification on the Muslim Brotherhood's English language website, where they said, well, we didn't really mean caliphate. What we meant was sort of like a European Union kind of thing. Well, you know, if you speak Arabic, caliphate is khalifa, and the union is ittihad. I mean, they're entirely different. They wanted to say what they wanted to say, they would have said it. So very clearly, they do have an expansionist, sort of different view of how they want to organize the region. But even if the Muslim Brotherhood is moderate, even if you want to stipulate that they are moderate, and they're not, they won't be for long, because they're sitting in a parliament with the Salafis. The Salafis are going to actually push the Muslim Brotherhood to the right. So, for example, what do the Salafis want? The Salafis talk about the jizya, that they're going to tax non-believers. So the Christians will be taxed, have a special tax on Christians. They're talking about, they say that they're not animals like the, I heard this actually in person. I was an election monitor, an international election monitor in Egypt in December, and I went to Middle Bay in the Delta, and it's full of Salafis. And I talked to some of these guys because they were like election monitors. And they talked about, you know, what they want to do in Egypt. They talked about the jizya, they talked about banning alcohol, they talked about all women wearing hijab. You know, mandatory. They talked about, you know, banning bikinis on the beaches. They also talked. They said we're not like the Taliban. You know, we're not uncivilized. There's a prohibition in Islam. I don't know if you know about idol worship, right? right? You have all these statues of the pharaohs in Egypt, right? This is why people come to Egypt to see these things. So they said, well, we're not going to destroy them like Bamiyan, you know, like the giant Buddhas of the Taliban, right? No, we're not like that. We're just going to encase the faces of the pharaohs in wax, right? So there won't be idol worship. So they're, you know, they're very modern, these guys. But the Salafis agree with the Muslim Brotherhood about that caliph. I mean, at the end of the day, they want a caliphate. They want an Islamic state. And they don't talk much, we'll get to foreign policy in a second, but they're really focused on social issues in Egypt, the Salafis. And I think across the region, as you look at what these Salafis want, they're not talking about destroying Israel, killing Americans. They're talking about implementing Sharia law in their own countries. And we're going to see this coming. That's the question, right? It's not a matter of foreign policy domestic policy. It's a matter of difference between the Brotherhood and the Salafis of how and how quickly Sharia law will be implemented. That's the difference. So I don't think Egypt is en route to becoming a democracy or is a democracy. What I think it is going forward is a competitive theocracy. That's what it's going to look like. Right? You're going to be competing on how much of an Islamic state Egypt will be. All right, the third trend. This is the post-Mubarak populist politics in Egypt and the future orientation of Egypt. What this means, right? All politics right now is grandstanding in Egypt, whether this is about Israel, whether it's about the United States, whether it's about domestic issues. Both the Freedom and Justice Party chairman and the vice chairman, a guy named Mohamed Morsi, is the chairman of the Freedom and Justice Party, a guy named Yassam al-Adiyam is the vice chair of the party. They both say, publicly, they say that the international community, in particular the United States, that they owe Egypt financial assistance. The United States owes Egypt financial assistance. Really? Why? Well, it's because of all of our years of supporting Mubarak. It's like compensation. Like, we owe Egypt money, $1.55 billion a year. Now, they're going to get into there's going to be a change in this. Because it's not, this 1.55, only 250 million of this goes to the civilian side, right? 1.3 goes to the military. The civilians, the Muslim Brotherhood, say, hey, what about us? Right? They're not talking about maintaining the aid, they're talking about increasing the aid. And that's irregardless of what kind of policies they pursue. Because it's guaranteed that they're going to pursue different policies about women, that they're going to pursue different policies on human rights, that maybe perhaps be better than Mubarak's, but about protections of minorities. I don't think we're going to see this improve. It was bad under Mubarak. I don't know if it's, I dare say it's probably not going to be any better under the Brotherhood. This populism will lead the government of Egypt to provoke us, to stick out their fingers in our eye. Right? They want the aid. Right? But we have this NGO crisis, right? Democracy promotion, liberal democracy promotion. What of that in Egypt? Well, we saw just a few months back, we had this crisis with the NGOs, right? We had people from National Democratic Institute and International Republican Institute that are doing democratic development work there. Their offices were raided by the government, and they were prohibited from leaving the country, including most famously Sam LaHood, who is Raylan, the Secretary of Transportation's son. He's the Egypt director of IRI. And actually, you know, he's the person who brought me out in the election. We had a couple of years, 2 weeks before he was arrested. Nice guy. So they're going to provoke us. In fact, this may be, in a way, a strategy to ensure that we continue to pay them. Right? It seems like counterintuitive, but Egypt will have to prove its relevance continuously to us, because if they're acting badly in terms of minorities, of women, etc., you're not going to have a whole lot of congressional support necessarily. But what they'll do is try and raise their value, raise rents from us by provoking periodically crises. And so essentially, they're going to try and extract rents from us to help either get out of crises or avoid future crises. I think we can expect more of this. The populism will contribute to that. The populism makes sense for these people. Particularly if you want to distract from the leading crisis that Egypt is facing right now, which is economic. And we'll get to the economy in a few minutes. At the same time, the polls in Egypt show that 70% of Egyptians don't want U.S. funding. Now, the Brotherhood, on the leadership level, wants its funding because of the economic crisis. But 70% of Egyptians would poll would say that. Approval went when polled. Egyptians say 21% of Egyptians support or give approval to the Iranian leadership. Only 19% of Egyptians approve of U.S. leadership. The negatives on the U.S. are higher than on Iran. We compare that to during the Mubarak era. Mubarak was, you know, had an ongoing fight with Iran. So it's been a dramatic change. And I think it'll be reflected, perhaps, in policy, too. So what does this mean in terms of the long-term bilateral relationship between the United States and Egypt? It's a big question. What are our key strategic requirements? What do we need from Egypt? What do we need from them? Well, it means three things, right? You can change the order if you want, but number one, priority access to Suez Canal. Number two, overflights and access to Cairo West Air Force Base. A lot of overflights with no warning. You know, they can slow roll us by saying, you know, hey, you've got an overflight tomorrow. No, you need a week's notice. You know, they can make big problems for us, or we can put our carriers in the back of the line instead of moving to the front of the line, moving through the canal. And finally, perhaps most importantly, maintaining the Camp David peace treaty with Israel that we underwrite. So the fourth issue, what does this mean for the peace treaty with Israel, this new government in Egypt? Well, we've already heard from senior Muslim Brotherhood leadership that a cut in U.S. aid will lead to a revision of the peace treaty by the Egyptian government. They said that. You can read it in the Washington Post. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't like Israel very much. I don't think that's a secret to anything. They voted on a resolution in Parliament just last week, I believe it was, to declare Israel enemy number one and to expel the Israeli ambassador from Cairo. Now, they've also decided, and I think it's sort of irrelevant, to stop natural gas sales to Israel. But that's really none of our business. In any event, the pipeline is blowing up. It's blown up 13 times in Sinai since the revolution. So there's no gas or oil flowing anywhere. And we'll get to the Sinai in a few minutes as well. But what does it mean? Well, the resolution itself, right, declaring Israel enemy number one, etc., it's non-binding. Because the Muslim Brotherhood, while they have the parliament, they don't have the executive, they don't control the country, right? Who's in charge of the country? It's the military, right? The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SCAF, as it's known. So SCAF is still in charge. As long as SCAF has its way, as long as it's still in charge, the foreign policy of Egypt will remain relatively constant. I don't think there's any doubt about that in terms of the views of the United States. There will be a very close working relationship with Israel. That's going to remain in place. But the SCAF is supposed to step down in June after they have presidential elections. They're supposed to step down, have a presidential election, have a new executive, right, a new government, and the military will return to the barracks. So what happens then? Well, we'll see. In the midterm, in the short term, I believe that there's going to be no threat to the peace treaty to change the dramatic changes in Egyptian foreign policy or policy vis-a-vis its neighbors. And why is that? It's because of the economy. We're going to talk about the economy in a few minutes as well. Point number five. What happens when the military returns to barracks? What happens? Well, some people believe that there's already a deal between the SCAF, between the military commanders, and the Muslim Brotherhood. The deal is that the military will remain in control of the national security issues and the foreign policy of Egypt, and that the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis will have free reign to determine social policy and domestic policy in Egypt. The military has no interest in any of them in being in charge of the economy, right? They own a certain percentage of the economy, some say up to 30%. When you guys go and do Bright Star, which was canceled this year, and you do Bright Star, the military are the people that sell you the water, right? They make a profit on it. They own 30%, an estimated 20 to 30% of the economy is run by the military in Egypt. But they don't want to determine sort of these large issues and be the scapegoat when the economy goes into the even worse crisis. Well, it's unclear whether this deal has actually been cut. It would lead, certainly, to even further Islamization of society. But right now, we're seeing increasing tensions between the Muslim Brotherhood and the SCAF, because the Islamists want to, first, remove the government that was appointed by the SCAF. They don't want to wait until June to get their own government. They want to remove the current government. There's a mini-crisis over this. The second thing is that the Islamists say they want to run their own presidential candidate. Right? This is a concern for the SCAF, because the SCAF was hoping that you would have sort of a liberal, more liberal, more technocratic government that was in charge of these issues, like the foreign affairs and national security. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood now says they want to run a presidential candidate, and they are mobilizing right now from their base. And they will win if the Muslim Brotherhood advocates a candidate. The candidate will be Amr Moussa, the former head of the Arab League and former minister of Egypt. There's much doubt about that. Conflict in the long term between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood, I think, is inevitable. I don't think it's escapable. Well, why is that? Well, in my view, I think both the military and the Muslim Brotherhood want to implement the Turkey model. It's just a difference of which Turkey model we're talking about. Right, you have the old Turkey model, right, where the military was a guardian of secular democracy in Turkey, right, when they had a government that was appointed that they didn't like or that was too Islamist, they had a coup, they removed the government, and they went back to elections, you know, and had another government. This happened several times in the 80s. But over time, right, that's one view of the military. They like that view, that it has this sort of ongoing perpetual control over society and politics. The other view is the more recent view of the Turkey model, which is that the Islamists, like Erdogan, from the AKP, the Turkish Islamist Party, gets elected, and they take over parliament, and they change it more to a presidential system. And they, over time, they bring the military to heel. How do they do that? Well, in Turkey, they've done it by arresting the senior officers under something called the Ergenekon Plan, which they claim that there's another coup in the process, and they've arrested all the senior leadership of the military that doesn't like the Islamists. And now the military can't do anything. So the civilians that essentially have control of the military now in Turkey. So these are competing Turkey models. Right? The military wants the old model, the Islamists want the new model. There's going to be conflict over this, no doubt. Because there's going to come a time when the Islamists say, hey, you stay in the barracks, we're going to turn the fight again. And you'll see this happen when there's a fight over who the next Minister of Defense will be in Egypt. Right? The military says the red line is that the Minister of Defense will be a general, an active duty general. It is a red line. You might see a fight over this. Maybe not now, maybe a couple years from now. This is going to be an issue. This is going to go across a broad range of issues. The military, we're going to talk about the Constitution in a minute, but the military wanted to insert several clauses into the Constitution. One clause they wanted to insert was that the Parliament and government will have nothing to say about the military's budget. The second is that any law that Parliament passes or wants to pass about dealing with issues related to the military have to be approved by the military. Right? This is what they wanted to insert in the Constitution. And the Brotherhood's not going for it. That's not going to get in there. Right? There's going to be a big fight over this. So keep your eye on that moving forward. Now, to go back to Camp David, if the military is not there anymore, the military are the people in Egypt. SCAF are the only people in Egypt that really want to maintain a peace treaty with Israel. So what happens if they're not there anymore? Well, if the peace treaty goes, I don't think it's going to go anytime soon, but if the peace treaty goes, you can count, you can, you know, bet your bottom dollar that the peace treaty is going to go in Jordan, too. Jordan's not going to stand alone as the only country that has a peace treaty. So it's not going to be tenable for them to do so. On a related point, it's the point number six. At the time of the revolution, everybody applauded the performance of the military. Right? Isn't the military great? They're disciplined. They didn't open fire on the crowds. The White House actually took credit. Right? We take credit because we've had this relationship, this working relationship with the military for the past how many years? Since 1979. Right? $66 billion we provided Egypt with since 1979. And this is what it bought us. It bought us that the Egyptian military come in time didn't open fire in the crowds. We've said that. Or not. Just, is this a reflection of our influence in Egypt? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. I don't think, first of all, that we have very much influence with the staff, with the military at all right now. I think that's overstated. Second of all, I think it's quite possible that Mubarak would have given off orders to the military to open fire on the crowds. It's quite possible he would have, if he thought, and the order, if he thought the orders actually would have been implemented. I don't think if an order was given, that the military would have stayed coherent. I think it would have fallen apart. I don't think the order would have been followed. The conscripts would have done it. Key point, though, is that we've had this abiding confidence in the SCAP. We've had this abiding confidence that the SCAP is actually competent. I think we have to look and question whether they are actually competent. I don't think so. I think it's a misplaced confidence. I'll give you several examples. One is this issue of the Constitution drafting. The Constitution, right? The SCAP originally said, when they laid this out, that the parliament was going to be elected. What was the parliament going to do? The key task of the new parliament in Egypt was going to be that they were going to appoint the Constitution drafting committee. That was going to be the key role of the parliament. They would draft a new constitution. They would pick the people that would draft the new constitution. Well, after a little while, you saw the first round of the elections and how well the Muslim Brotherhood was doing and how well the Salafis were doing. The military said, hey, wait a minute. If these guys are always honest and they get to pick the 100-member constitution drafting committee, then you're going to have a Sharia law constitution. And this is not going to be good for us. So they changed the rules. They said, well, actually, the new parliament, they're only going to appoint 20%. Only 20 people of the 100 on this constitution draft. And you know what? The military is going to appoint the other 80 people. Right? Well, the Islamists said, hell no. And then they had a big fight over it, and the military gave in. They said, okay, you guys get to appoint everybody. That was one. They thought they could actually get this by everybody. Right? That they thought they could actually manage the process. They also mismanaged the NGO crisis, right? There's a woman named Faiza Abu Naga who's been the head of international cooperation in Egypt for decades, even under Mubarak. She's still that head right now, and she has no love for America. She actually most likely gave the order to the Ministry of Justice to arrest or put out arrest warrants or not let these Americans leave the country. And the SCAP didn't do anything about it, right? This is a crisis that was invented for no reason, and the SCAP oversaw it. The final example I'll give you of SCAP incompetence is the insecurity in Egypt. There's no security in Egypt right now. That's the third trend. It's number seven trend. Insecurity in Egypt. This is a huge problem. It's hard to explain it, but during the revolution, the police and the internal security of the country basically crumbled. Right? The internal security basically lit up with files on fire so that they wouldn't be held responsible or accountable later for all the acts of torture they perpetrated, etc., all the files they were keeping on people. And the police, after the revolution, were no longer able to extract this high level of corrupt, you know, bribes from people, so they don't come into work all that much anymore. You have weapons that are flowing over the border from places like Libya. You have 560 weapons that were just taken last week coming across the border. And the government says it's only 1/10 of what's coming into the country. I know people, middle class people in Egypt, who have actually bought not only AK-47s for their own personal safety, but anti-aircraft weapons to keep in their house. You have a crime rate now. Carjackings, bank robberies, rape, armed robbery, things that you never saw in Egypt. Now, mind you, none of this compares to Washington, D.C. This is, you know, 100 times worse than it ever was in Egypt. And in the polls, nearly 50% of Egyptians say they don't feel safe. And there's good reason for it. There's a big story on this in the Washington Post, actually, a week or so ago. I encourage you to read it. It's a real big problem. And the SCAP hasn't been able to get a hold of it. The interior security, they are reorganizing, but it's not happening, it's a big problem. This has an effect, I'll talk about the effect in a second. The caller earlier related to that is number eight trend, which is terrorism, right? We're seeing a deterioration in this time. We are seeing, you know, part of the insecurity was that during the revolution, all the jails were empty. Right? So you had people, in 2011, for example, there were 50 guys. It was a 50-member cell, 25 guys from Hezbollah in Lebanon were arrested and put in jail in Egypt. These guys escaped. They went back to Lebanon. And a whole bunch of people from Hamas who were in jail, they made it back to Gaza. They interviewed them on Al Jazeera. Right? But all the common criminals and other terrorist suspects, security person, also escaped and went home. A lot of them went to the Sinai. The Sinai has always been overlooked by the Egyptian government. It's never been never received resources. It's mostly Bedouin. It's not, you know, never got the financial assistance, etc. Other places in Egypt. But after all these people fled back, we started to see increased acts of terrorism. First, we saw the bombings of pipelines, right? 13 to date. They cannot secure the oil pipeline, the gas pipeline to Jordan and Israel, right? That's a given. There's a long history of terrorism in Sinai. In 1985, 7 Israelis were killed on a bus, and terrorist attacks in Dahab, Sharm el Sheikh, Taba. A lot of these things. We're seeing even more of them now. In fact, this past year, you had a group called Ansar al-Jihad, a Al-Qaeda affiliate, established itself in Sinai. This group actually attacked a local police station in Al-Arish, and they issued a statement by Al-Qaeda in the Sinai Peninsula, demanding the implementation of Sharia law in the Sinai, and the establishment of an Islamic emirate in the Sinai. Right? It's lawless in the Sinai right now. That same month, via the internet, Ayman Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, who happens to be an Egyptian national, encouraged these Al-Qaeda affiliates to attack Israelis, to bomb the pipeline again, and to hit American targets as well. And one of these groups on Sahel Jihad declared their loyalty to Zawahiri. So this is going on. This is ongoing. And of course, we've also had an increase in kidnappings. There's been Americans kidnapped, Chinese kidnapped, and other nationalities kidnapped. The MFO in 2005, 2006, the Multinational Force Observers, the guys who make sure that Egypt, the Egyptian military is abiding by its commitments, was attacked in 2005 and 2006. Just 2 weeks ago, some armed Bedouins surrounded Al-Ghoura, the base of the MFO. Wouldn't let the MFO troops out. Or they're demanding the release of Bedouin prisoners who had been imprisoned in 2004 for killing Americans and Israelis in Dahab and Sharm el-Sheikh. Right? This is a lawless area. It's a big problem. Because if any of you have ever been to Sharm el-Sheikh, this is a huge tourist destination for Europeans. And tourism is more than 10 to 15% of the Egyptian economy. Right? So what does it mean about the economy? This is the ninth point. I'll go through the rest really quickly because I've talked enough. The economy. What does the economy need to look like? Right? The standard has been, you know, the standard number everyone throws out is 40% of the people in Egypt make less than $2 a day. Well, I was back here in December. I went to Hano Falili to buy some trinkets for my kids. Right before I came back to the little market, it's usually a place packed with tourists. I was the only tourist in there. I had a guy come up to me and try to sell me a little perfume thing. I said, no. The guy was basically, he went from $20 to basically 20 cents within 1 minute. I've never seen anybody debase himself so much. It's so critical, the economy right now. It's in such a bad shape. Because of the insecurity, no tourists have come to Egypt. So now I'd say that roughly 50% of the people in Egypt are making less than $2 a day. Foreign reserves have dropped from $36 billion to $10 billion since the revolution. They're burning through at a rate of $1 billion a month. They just negotiated a $3 billion loan from the IMF that will carry them for 3 months. There's no tourists. There's also no foreign direct investment. Nobody's going to invest in this country because they don't know what the rules are going to be. Whether the Muslim Brotherhood will nationalize businesses, and they're still investigating all the former people from the Mubarak era and undoing deals that were signed. So nobody wants to invest there. The economy is in terrible shape, and it's not going to get fixed anytime soon. The Brotherhood has made a number of statements. They went to the stock market to say, hey, we believe in a free market economy. They are going around and visiting all these Egyptian these Egyptian people that used to be the head of the economy that are living in Europe in exile, saying, well, if they come back, they'll be arrested. And they're asking them how to run an economy. Because Egypt, before the revolution, was doing like 7% GDP growth a year. Now, there wasn't very much trickle down, but at least they had good numbers. In 2008, during the global financial meltdown, we had negative growth in this country. They had 4% growth in Egypt. They were doing pretty good. And the little person didn't see that very much. But the country's doing very good. That doesn't exist anymore. Two more points, very quick. Number 10, the consolidation of the Islamic State. What are we looking at here? What should we be looking at in terms of the progress of making this an Islamic State? Well, the Freedom Justice Party last week, and Al-Noor actually moved ahead and selected all the 100 authors of the new Constitution Writing Committee. The final selection of these members reflected party and ideological loyalties and excluded constitutional jurists, thinkers, scholars, intellectuals, activists, women, and didn't have any reflection of the cultural and ethnic diversity. In fact, there were 2,700 names in a pot. They picked out 100 of these people with 40 substitutes. And this one list was given to the parliament, and they rubber stamped it without having any discussion with it. So in terms of diversity, we got six women out of 100, two of whom are members of the Freedom Justice Party, and only six Christians, including two of the women. Right? So six Christians, maybe 10% of Egypt. And a few liberals were appointed, a guy named Omar Hamzawi, who was a bona fide liberal, a woman named Mona Amar Mohamed, they were selling. So this is all Islamist. Right? You're going to get an Islamist constitution, you're going to get Sharia law. The debate, as I said earlier, will be how Islamist, how Sunni. What the Salafis told me when I was talking to them in Menophilia, they said, we know in Egypt that you cannot implement the Hudud right away. What's the Hudud? The Hudud is the punishment of the hand the third time you steal, right? We can't do that immediately because Egypt's too poor. We have to improve the economy a little bit, and then we'll implement it. Now, that's what we're talking about, how fast they will implement this kind of thing. Last point is foreign relations. We'll see what's happening with Egypt's relations with the countries that surround it, whether it be Israel, whether it be Libya, Tunisia, etc. My guess is they're going to have very good relations with Tunisia because of the Muslim Brotherhood connection. They're going to forge a relationship with Libya that's going to be a lot more productive than it was during the Gaddafi era. But this is a state that's going to be primarily looking inward, I think, for the coming year or two. In Syria, just make one final point here. Iran, we don't know where that's going to go because Sunni Muslim regimes typically don't like Shiite Iran too much. But there is a healthy perspective, and oddly enough, for Iran within Egypt these days, the government may have to reflect that a little bit more. But the last point being Syria, the head of the Arab League is an Egyptian guy. He's always an Egyptian guy. It's a guy named Nabil Omar, or Nabil Al-Arabi. And Nabil Al-Arabi is the head of the Arab League. And he has been guiding the Arab League on their decisions on Syria. But this is basically Egyptian foreign policy, right? This guy who represented the foreign ministry of Egypt. Saudi Arabia doesn't really like how Egypt has been handling the Arab League in terms of Syria. Right? Saudi wants a more forward-leaning policy. One of Saudi's daily newspapers based in London called Sharq al-Assad, they had their lead commentator just a month or two ago write an op-ed about Nabil al-Arabi and the Arab League position on Syria, and they referred to Nabil al-Arabi as a conspirator, conspiring with Bashar al-Assad to keep Assad in power. So you're going to see some Saudi-Egyptian differences come out. I think there was always sort of a rivalry, but I think that will peak a little bit. It's interesting, just in terms of the intra-Arab politics, but Qatar and Saudi have a long rivalry, and a lot of that's playing out in the Arab League, in the Arab world right now, with the Saudis funding the Salafis, and the Qataris funding the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think we're going to watch that play out in Egypt. And with that, I think that's good enough. Happy to take your questions.
Thank you.
You want to sit here?
Yeah, okay.
Can I ask the first question, please? This is a question that you raised early on the issue of that you said Egypt is not going to be a democracy now, but later it will be a competitive theocracy. My question is, with Egypt is the most greatest focus because of what you just said, the importance, but as a whole, we have these trends, Tunisia, Egypt. Some people say if there is an election held today in Syria, the Brotherhood would be the best party to win. You mentioned the AKP in Turkey, Hamas, of course, a while ago. The question is, when you read the Arab media, they say, well, democracy for the West is a pro-Western system, not so much an election-based system. So, for us sitting here, which democracy is our greatest asset, we are the vanguards of democracy, we push it forward. How to reconcile this, that, okay, I hope that you say the Egyptian world was very open, at least the Egyptian standard, going back to Mubarak, that these people win. How would we here live with the situation that people that are very unsavory to the United States, perhaps, keep on getting elected? We don't call it democracy because they're unsavory, yet they go to the ballot. So this is the dilemma more than anything else. Just to comment on that, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're looking at, we have to give these people time, I suppose, right? They have no culture of democracy. It takes time. And, of course, I think the key problem, of course, was that there wasn't much time between the revolution and the elections, right? Elections, as we well know, aren't democracy, right? It's a culmination of democracy. They don't, there wasn't any time for liberal parties to really organize well. They didn't have an infrastructure like the Muslim Brotherhood had established here at a distinct disadvantage. That said, they probably would have lost very badly regardless. I think, we have to determine what our policies are. They can choose whoever they want to choose, but we're going to have to determine, whether we get along with them or what type of relationship we can have with them. I think we want to have a productive relationship with Egypt, but it becomes very difficult if, Christians are, even more repressed there, if women have no rights, if society is, Sharia law implemented, it makes it more difficult. Now, we do have good relations with Saudi Arabia, right? These are countries that we think have atrocious or foreign political systems. But it's more difficult. We don't share a regional view. We don't share a world view. We don't even share the very simple values. I mean, we share a value for life, perhaps. But not a worldview about what about liberty. So it's going to be a very difficult time coming ahead. I would say to people in the region that you are entitled to vote for whoever you want. But after these elections, for example, in a place like Turkey, if you read the Human Rights Report, they're getting worse and worse reviews every year. The freedom of the press is going in the can. Right, they're arresting people that are writing against the government, they're throwing them in jail. This is not a good democratic practice. It doesn't reflect much. It reflects authoritarian, that they changed, authoritarianism to the ballot. To the ballot from autocracy to theocracy. It's not, that's not democracy either. Just because they get elected doesn't mean, one man, one vote, one time. So they're entitled to their views, but we have to make our decision. Hamas won the parliament in Palestinian Authority. Doesn't mean we're going to fund Hamas. Doesn't mean we're going to... Palestinians have a choice. We have a choice that reflects our values.
Thank you. The floor is open.
Yes, sir. Please. Where's the upper class in Egypt society stand? Are they Muslim Brotherhood, or are they military backed?
The
educated, I guess.
Yeah, well, the Muslim Brotherhood, actually, the mid-tier and senior leadership is middle class, upper middle class. These are lawyers and doctors and professionals. They're not, uneducated. They may have people who support them who are, the less educated, obviously, because they want to leave votes. But no, it's that's middle class or upper middle class. And then you have
the upper class and the extremely wealthy, who I think are concerned about income redistribution, about whether Egypt is going to slide back on economic reforms that they've been doing. You have this huge subsidy system in Egypt that has not really worked very well. I mean, people are dependent on it, but let me give you an example. During the Mubarak era, and so I'm maybe moving away from your question there, but I'll come back to it at the end. During the Mubarak era, they would, bread was heavily subsidized. Egyptians eat more bread per capita than any other people in the world. Egypt is actually the largest importer of wheat in the world as well. They can't feed themselves. So the government heavily subsidized wheat and bread. And so what they do is they have these government bakers, and they deliver subsidized bags of wheat to the bakers so they could bake the bread and sell it to the people. And a loaf of pita costs like 1 cent. They go to 1 cent. But what was happening was two things. One was that these bags of wheat, the bakers discovered that if you're given a bag for $5 and the true value is 15, you could sell it for 10 and make a $5, why bother baking it? So there was a shortage of bread. The other thing people were doing was, because the bread was so cheap, they were buying it and using it to feed their animals, their livestock. Right? It was a whole very corrupt system. Eventually, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, the army stepped in to bake bread in Egypt. So the upper class in Egypt is concerned about what's going to happen in terms of income redistribution, because the clarion cry of the revolution was not, Sharia law. The clarion cry wasn't corruption of Mubarak, although that was part of it. It was really what they call the adl al-ijtimaiyya, the social justice, right? That and when polled, some 60 to 70% of Egyptians say that the main reason they came out in the demonstrations was for economic reasons. So there, people are expecting that their lives will improve. 80% of Egyptians say that they thought their lives would improve in the first year, and it's declined. So what is the government going to do about this? They're going to increase subsidies. They already have a budget deficit, right? There's no revenues coming in because business isn't being done. They have a demonstration every Friday. People aren't coming. So the rich people are scared of what's going to happen to them. And I think a lot of them, when I went there shortly after the revolution, I asked a friend, hey, I want to go interview some people from the business community, talk to them about how they see the revolution. He said, they don't have any here. You're going to have to go to Europe. Right? Because they all left the country. You know, where they're going to be arrested. And like I said, this guy that I knew, he actually worked for Morgan Stanley in Egypt. Very rich guy, and he has a farm somewhere out in the countryside, and his family heavily armed because they were afraid that the lawless environment is just going to be overrun by the peasantry. So I think a lot of people are very concerned about where this is going.
Yes, please.
So, Samuel, to Master, how do you see the Salafist and Muslim Brotherhood communicating with the populace in the future to influence them? You've seen quite a lot about social media, but from your experiences, especially from the election in December, what types of communication systems, media systems, are they now using to influence?
Because, the cities and the middle class has watching YouTube every day, and all these guys have websites. Salafis have a website. They have a newspaper. The Salafi paper, it's called the Muslimun. The Ikhwan has their own papers. They have, websites that are updated every minute. They also have right now something called Al Jazeera Mubashir, which is the direct Egyptian Al Jazeera TV that is 24 hours on Egypt. It's a specific channel. And a lot of people watch them. They're interviewing people all the time. They also have parliamentary TV. Right, which is like C-SPAN. You can watch the whole full session, and people get up and they grandstand. Now, how so? There's a great video you can actually watch it. I think somebody sent it to me, but I think it's since been translated by Memory, which is sort of a group. If you go to www.memri.org, it's of this guy Hazem Abu Ismail. He's like a leading Salafi, and he's standing in the back of the parliament, and he stands up and he says, you know, Allah, 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 and calling and listens to prayer, right? And the speaker of the parliament, this guy, Khatati, who's, you know, a senior member of the Muslim Brotherhood, like shouts him down, like, what the hell are you doing? Sit down, you know? And the guy is saying, hey, it's time to pray. We all got to go and pray. And Khatati says, what? You think you guys like to pray more than us? You're no more Muslim than we are. This is a government. We got to get on with it. But Egyptians are watching this and saying, well, maybe there's this kind of thing going on, and you're going to see more and more of it caving between the groups, criticizing the groups. And during the election, you actually have clashes between the Salafis and the Muslim Brotherhood in polling places. I don't want to overestimate or overstate the social media in Egypt. Social media worked for the liberals, the middle-class liberals who came out and did the revolution. You know, they organized people, they had these days of rage, they had, you know, great Facebook pages, they got a million signatures on Baradei for president, right? Where's Baradei now? And it doesn't really mean that much. It's word of mouth, I think, on the village level, sir.
Professor Susan, please.
Hey, Doug, how are you?
David, how are you?
Good to see you.
Could you talk a little more about the ideologies of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis in particular? Are the Salafis really even trying to say acquittive? Are the Salafis talking about Takfir?
I haven't seen any of the type of Takfir stuff. Is basically when you declare people who are both not Muslim, and when you declare people who are Muslim but not practicing enough, to declare them a kafir or an infidel. And we know the penalty for being infidel. So this is a stream of thought that is prevalent in the jihadi groups, that it's okay to kill Muslims if they're not Muslim enough or they're not promoting this view. I've not seen any of that among the Salafis yet. What I'm seeing is, you know, talk about social issues in Egypt. Very early on, the Salafis are coming out and, you know, saying about the hudud, we got to cut the hands, we got to, you know, force the hijab, there's not going to be any alcohol in the country, this is what it's going to be, and we're going to legislate this immediately and force Egypt into this position. And you had Yusuf Qardawi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, who's based in Qatar, but an Egyptian guy, who said, you know, hey, you Salafi guys, you're new to this stuff, don't get ahead of yourself. Speak softly and carry a big stick. You know, don't be boastful about it. Don't force this down people's throat. Be politic about it. Don't worry, we're going to do it. So in terms of ideology, I haven't read enough about it, but I'm not seeing sort of this, you know, this deep sort of even Tamiya stuff that you expect to see. I think from from the theologians anyway. I haven't been following the. That
well, I would suggest that the Salafis are more reactionary socially and less revolutionary, and that what you're not seeing supports that argument, although as you well point out, the case is still open.
I think all these guys recognize that they have an opportunity here, and that if they push it too far, we saw the agreement with the Muslim Brotherhood when they suggested that they might remove the SCAF-appointed government. The military issued an announcement saying, we don't want to go back to the bad old days, basically when we threw Muslim Brothers in jail. Now, I think it's an empty threat. I don't think they can do it. But nobody wants to push too hard right now.
Hi, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Hollinger with the Faculty of the Joint Forces Staff College. Thanks for the invitation to come up. I'm curious as to the what do you see as a possible red line with regards to the peace treaty, the Camp David Accord? You mentioned that you don't think that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to try to abrogate the treaty anytime soon, and that the current executive doesn't want that to happen. But they're using it. It seems that they may be using it as a lever to kind of extort aid from us. Is there anything perhaps that Israel could do that might change that dynamic? I mean, if Israel does something vis-a-vis Iran, or is there anything that we could do that you think could change that dynamic, or do you feel like it's fairly stable for the time being?
They had these reports of Israelis flying drones over the Sinai, going out and whacking Al-Qaeda groups. I don't know if they're reliable reports, but you've had a couple problems in Sinai along the border. You had, you know, that one incident of terrorism where you had, you know, a huge cell do a sequenced operation crossing over from Egypt into Israel, shooting up a couple buses. Then the Israelis came in and did hot pursuit and ended up killing five Egyptian policemen on the border. And, you know, things got out of control back in Cairo, and they eventually had a crowd and they went and stormed the Israeli embassy and almost killed six Israeli diplomats before the military stepped in. I think that these can be major irritants in the relationship. The border itself has traditionally not been very well secured. Guys would come and go. They bring not only drugs, but women, trafficking into Israel, and into Jordan, in fact, all the way across. And that's been sort of, you know, time and time immemorial. But now, and you also had, you know, basically once every, I don't know what it is, once every 300 kilometers, or, I don't know what it is, how far, they're very far spaced Egyptian border posts on that border, and they don't have running water, nor do they have food, and actually the IDF, the Israeli forces, actually feed these people, the Egyptian soldiers out there, they're not really doing much work. You had, you know, cells from Gaza, of Hamas, coming to Egypt. They had pre-positioned missiles, they fired them at a lot, and one of them actually hit Aqaba in Jordan this year. This kind of thing can happen. It's hard to stop. There are hundreds, literally, of tunnels with Gaza, and basically it's lawless in the Sinai. The Israelis are most of the way done in actually building a 10-meter wall stretching from Gaza all the way to Tama. You know, so it's going to be harder for people to move. It also goes, you know, several meters underground, so it's going to be harder to dig under, and I'm sure they're going to do some stuff with a technical fence as well. This could be an irritant going forward. How's that going to be resolved, or what's going to happen there? I think you're going to see an end to the gas sales. I think everybody in Egypt agrees to that. Mind you, Jordan pays less for gas than Israel does. But okay, I mean, this is not an issue that we care about. The Israelis will just have to spend more money buying the open market. But I think the real issue will come in when the Egyptians, or somebody says, hey, we need more troops in Sinai to control this Al-Qaeda problem. Now, the Egyptians and the Egyptian armed forces staff and the Israelis talk every day at the highest levels. Both sides say the working relationship is great. They don't say it publicly, but they say it. And as long as this gap is in a position to dictate its deployments, the Israelis have approved 10 times or more increased numbers of Egyptian troops in the summer. But you're going to have a problem if the MFO keeps on getting hit, right, or starts getting hit on a routine basis, will it stay there? What's the future of all of Harvest? You know, the U-2 flights over the Sinai. Are we going to keep doing those? Will Egypt want us to keep doing those? Well, that's, you know, we're violating Egyptian airspace if we don't have their permission. This is what, you know, measures how many tanks there are in the Sinai. So there are complicating factors here. I don't frankly think the military are the people that stop Al-Qaeda in the Sinai. Muharrat is in charge of the Sinai, you know, sort of an external security force, but they have to be on the village level and figure out who's going where and spy on people. I mean, that's, you know, what the government of Egypt traditionally does. But I can see it, you know, sort of deteriorating, but not all the way. I think that there's a medium point between abrogation and changing it so that the relationship becomes even less close.
Yes, please.
So the major cities in terms of exercising workers, what event do you see would be a good trigger for the United States to determine to not give aid to Egypt anymore?
That's a big one. You know, I really mixed feelings about it, you know, myself, because this is, you know, this is it's supposed to be leverage, right? But you know, you got one bullet in the chamber. You know, if you cut off that aid, if you try and condition it, you know, to different behavior, what would cause a trigger? Well, if the Israeli embassy was stormed, six Israeli diplomats were killed, and Hamawi didn't take President Obama's phone call that night and didn't dispatch special forces to get these guys out, then Congress would have cut it. You have change in Camp David that is so severe, where there's no monitors allowed of the Sinai, I think that could be a trigger. But you know, at this point, I think the Egyptians realize that actually we want to maintain the aid almost more than they do. It's odd, but we want to have some relationship to them, even marginal, because we have nothing. I mean, if you looked at it, you know, the Egyptian military, we can get access to them, but if we tell them to do something or request that they do something and they don't see it in their interest, they're not going to do it. The liberals in Egypt are powerless, but even they don't want to be seen as being close to the United States right now. The Islamists, of course, you know, are happy to talk to us and take our money, but they're not going to do anything we want them to do. We have very little influence in Egypt, despite the 66 million. And yet, you know, this is a matter of optics. To have this revolution, the Muslim Brotherhood take control, and you have basically a failing economy, and we're saying, hey, we're not going to fund you anymore because you're an Islamist government. It's a matter of public diplomacy. It's not very good. I think you're going to see the administration push in, you know, even if Congress isn't supportive, but we certainly lose some support. Congress, we have in some of this city.
Last question, all the way to the back.
Mr. Shanker, Peter Milano, I'm in City. I was in Egypt in November in the election. I just happened to be there for a wedding for my wife's, and I was there with my family, and very much heard a similar tenor to what you've been describing. Just we had this revolution, and now what? And what has this brought us? This brought us a theocracy, and this was mostly Coptics that I was staying with that we were talking. And one of the dynamics they described was, okay, you've got all these illiterate folks in Upper Egypt, in the south, and they're voting based on a symbol, and they can't even read the name. And I was wondering what your thoughts, how much of a factor that played into the election, and how much that may play into follow-on elections, and if there might be more of a swing when all of a sudden, you know, like you said, you can't wear bikinis or something. Not that that's a big issue, but...
Right. Well, you bring up two issues. You know, one is sort of the feeling of many Egyptians who are, you know, relatively low percentage of Egyptians, apparently, but liberal Egyptians who maybe are, you know, either personally pious or not, or don't want to vote what to do by the government. They didn't want to exchange authoritarianism for a theocracy. And I saw this sort of play out in one of these polling places. And when I was there, you know, after, when they were sealing the boxes, it took a very long time, when we were hanging out there. And these, you know, two young Salafi guys who were credentialed monitors were having a talk with a guy with Masrin al-Ahram, which is Magid Suwayris, the Christian richest guy in Egypt, funded a number of a political party called the Free Egyptians, which fared very poorly. I think he put 200 million into the elections and won, like, 20 seats. But they had a discussion, you know, going back and forth, where they said, well, you know, this is a, you know, Muslim country, you know, we should, you know, ban alcohol. And this other guy says, well, you know, I don't drink alcohol, but I don't mean to tell me to drink alcohol. You know, and these guys went back and forth on this for like 20 minutes. Like, why are you telling me what to do? Didn't we end this in Mubarak? So there are some people that feel like that. But, for better or for worse, it's a very relatively small number. The other issue that you raised was about illiteracy in Egypt and about the voting system. You know, I saw so many people there, you know, just doing the dipping their thumbs and putting their thumbprints on the sign for the election because they couldn't, they were illiterate. And it's a very high percentage in Egypt, depending on which polling station, which areas you go to. And there, you know, some people saying before, during the election, that people in the polling station were telling people what symbols to vote for. And very complicated ballots here, because you had the name of the party, but you also had the symbol. And if you were lucky enough, you'd get a good symbol. So the Freedom and Justice Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, got a scale. I mean, the scales of justice, right? They got a great one. But there's another guy who got like a basketball or sunglasses. You know, one guy got a tank, right? And for like a symbol of a political party. And not everybody knew, you know, what their symbols were. Now, one of the things that was illegal, but was happening a lot in the first stage, a lot in the second stage, but less so in the third stage, was that it was complicated about which, you had to know when you had the polling place, not only which polling place you had to go to, but which room and which box you were supposed to vote in. Now, they would tell you if you went there, but you might have to wait on a line, you'd find out you were in the wrong room, you had to go to another box. Or the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis and people who were organized had booths outside the polling places. And you could go up there and say, hey, I'm on the voting register here, can you tell me where I'm supposed to vote? And they wrote the name of the polling place on a piece of paper, on a colored piece of paper, the name of the polling place, which room, and which ballot box. And then on the back of the piece of paper would be the symbol of their party. And they'd carry this in and say, oh, this is the Muslim Brotherhood, I'm going to vote for these guys, or these are the Salafis, I'm going to vote for these guys. Now, it's illegal to give out the symbol on the day of the voting, within 24 hours. And the government cracked down on this in the third stage, but it's happened all along. My guess is that these people knew who they wanted to vote for. Like, hey, I want to vote for the Ikhwan. Who's the Ikhwan? And people in the polling place would tell them, you know, giving that kind of clue. But a lot of people actually went to vote in Egypt, oddly enough, because before the voting, there was a rule that a law passed that if you didn't vote, you were going to be fined 500 Egyptian pounds. It's $100, which had people making $2 a day. It's a huge fine. So people went out, you didn't know anything about any party. And I saw people show up at the polling booth and say, you know, hey, what do I do? Who do I vote for? And I saw the judge, in every polling place there was a judge, and I saw the judge like yell at these women, like, what the hell are you doing here? You know, you don't know anything. And the woman said, hey, I want to pay a fine. You know, you've got to be here. So a lot of people came out to vote for that. And it was funny because one judge told me, or someone told me at one point, a military officer told me, hey, you know, it turned out we didn't actually implement this fine. We're not doing it, and everybody knows that. I talked to all these judges, they thought it was a fine. So people vote for any number of reasons, but overall, I think, you know, it's realistic to assess that, you know, sympathies of the country were in this direction anyway. You know, a few points here and there, you're looking at the same thing, it's 75%. You know, maybe you've got 5-10% different. Doesn't make a difference.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Mr. Nichols.